Yeah, it's a true story. When I was a kid, I really was into computers and electronics. I tried to convince my parents to build our own computer at home. They didn't like the idea, but I thought, you know, guys, we should build a computer at home. It would be really cool. And so finally, they kind of joined in, and we tried for a while, but I had to give it up eventually. I just couldn't get my motherboard. Hey, hi, guys. Daniel Markham here with Nerd Roundup. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup, Nerd Roundup, what we do is we go over the tech news of the week, talk about what the other nerds are talking about. We're not necessarily nerds ourselves, but we do wrangle some nerds at part of our jobs every day. The goal here is to have fun, kick back, and goof off. I believe a team that can relax and talk about anything while they're having fun can about do damn near anything. It is not something I can teach you, but it's something I can demonstrate live every week. That's what we do. This week we have Mr. Scott Ambler and Mr. James Grinning. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Greetings.
Hola.
So, Scott, what have you been up to this past week?
Oh, just been working like a dog. It's simple as that. I was on vacation last week, so spent the last 3 days catching up on emails and all the meetings I was supposed to be, pretending to care about last week.
Mr. James. How about you, James?
Up visiting the granddaughters. Spent a few days with the kids up in Gainesville. So didn't do much work. Well, I did some work. I've got this first cohort going through my self-paced training class right now. So I'm kind of not babysitting. I'm reacting to their running into stuff that it's like, oh, yeah, that isn't so convenient to do, is it? You know, so.
That's the dreaded user testing.
Yeah. And then the dreaded person in charge of the system makes stupid mistakes that makes him look bad when he's talking to people about quality. You know, so. Then there's that, too.
Quality's job 7 here.
And fixing stuff, then I broke something, too, as well. You know, so that's always great. With not just a subtle breakage, but, sorry, you can't go to this website anymore kind of breakage.
You know, I still feel that what we do with the hands-on tech training, we work without nets many times. It's actually probably one of the better things we do because we have to be humble. I mean, if you can fake being humble, man, you got the rest of that stuff made, you know.
Got lots of reasons to be humble.
Well, I had a blast this past week. After we had our last week's Nerd Roundup, I realized we did not record any audio, and that was like the first bit of hella fun. And then I lost my entire notebook computer's hard drive, so I had to spend a day reinstalling my notebook computer. From there on, it got better, but right after the roundup last week, it was pretty rough.
So were you able to recover the speech using, you know, some sort of mouth syncing thing or, you know, lip reading?
Yeah, you know, I got the video, so I should have went back and, like, did voices. Hello, Daniel, how's it going? But I thought maybe, you know, people might catch on to that. I don't know.
I would suggest that you go back and do that, but you put it into, like, the super secret link set.
Hey, your video is looking great today, Greg. What's wrong? Something wrong with your computer system?
Yeah, there's something wrong there. There's a guy pretending to be Greg here.
Oh, wait. I know what the problem is.
Definitely bandwidth challenges. But he had a toque on.
I had the wrong hat on.
Ah.
No, that's not it. That's not it.
What is it? So, Greg, what have you been doing this week?
Lots of fun experimental coding.
Well, it sounds interesting.
And then you had an encounter with a razor, I think.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes, that did.
Oh, my God. Ah. Wow. I guess that witness protection program just isn't working out so well for you, Greg, huh?
It's been a bit lacking.
Yeah, it would be bad if the C++ guys had some sort of witness thing like for null pointer dereferencing and stuff, because I would be like on the top of the list for that. Okay, guys, let's kick off the articles of the week. We had a kind of a bunch of weird stuff this week.
Yeah, who picks out the news of the week anyway?
Well, I usually sit on the couch eating Fritos, and really feeling hungover or picking my nose or something, and I'm on Hacker News, and I go, hey, that's kind of neat, and I just paste it in, and in the week I go, what the hell did I put that in there for? So that is the sophisticated process we're currently using, but you guys are welcome to put your own links in. I told you all along, there's no rules here, really.
Oh, I actually had an interesting little story that came up. We were discussing the Postal Service in the U.S. So as I'm sure you know, over the last, 20 years or so, the U.S. Postal Service had started delivering a lot more things due to people like Amazon, eBay. Did you know that today they actually only have 30 to 40% less employees than they had in 2004?
Wow.
They've literally had all of these things put on them where they're doing all this more work, but they actually have far less employees.
I suppose when you're a government slacker that maybe you can take on some more work there.
There's a slow pitch from Greg.
I love our post jail. She's so great. I don't want to say anything bad about her.
Well, I couldn't believe it when I actually saw this because, well, a post office is generally considered a model of inefficiency.
hey, Benjamin Franklin started that. I'm sorry, Scott.
So I would assume they installed a robot or two over the years and a few mail processing machines.
Well, but it was just amazing for me to see that they are actually efficient. Literally, people talk about the post office as a model of inefficiency.
You know, it's funny. I went to the DMV about a year ago, and somebody had come in and did queue management because they were doing a freaking awesome job with queues there. They had a central line that validated your data. Then they had separate lines for each type of operation. It was looking good. It looked like some Rearston put together.
Well, what really worries me about all of this is, I mean, I am reasonably well known as being fairly libertarian and that government is incapable of doing any of this kind of stuff, but they're actually doing a somewhat reasonable job.
Who knew? I don't understand the post office. I can't comment on the post office because it's like carrying pieces of paper around. To me, it's like, hey, I can pick up a piece of paper and walk around. How hard could this be?
They're carrying boxes with stuff in them now, too.
I have done this as well many times.
And have you tried informed delivery? You can get a photo of all the mail that's coming to your mailbox, which is kind of cool. You know, if you have more than one mailbox, it's kind of nice to see what's going different places.
My neighbor did that for a while. The cops told him that he had to stop. It was a bad thing. Yeah, they're doing some cool stuff. I remember reading that they were doing optical character recognition in the post office back in the early 80s. They've been doing a lot of trying, and they've succeeded and failed. So, first story, famous Navy UFO video was camera glare, evidence suggests. So I'm interested in this story because it's how organizations learn, especially how they learn when they get information they can't process very well, which is UFOs are a great example of that. And Petapixel went in and looked at this UFO video and said, you know, actually, this is camera glare. So everybody went to their corners and had fusses over whether it's aliens or blah, blah, blah. As I understand the conversation, it was lens flare, but it was lens flare off of some real object that they still don't know what the hell it was, and there were still all kinds of other things they don't know. So this is interesting from a lot of ways. It sort of asks the question of, can you just keep picking apart stuff until there's nothing there, or is there some point where you kind of go, well, you know, it looks like there may have something may have actually happened?
I would assume that it was a glare off of the windshield of the spaceship.
That would be a reasonable first thing to rule out.
or pull in.
Could have been something the post office was operating, too. You don't know.
Glare off the robots in the post
ooh,
office.
Ooh, yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, the space-born robots.
Yes. Postal Service robots. It's hardly ever covered in the news. They're keeping that secret.
Well, of course. We don't want to welcome our robot overlords yet.
Speaking of robot overlords, and this horned dude is not one of those, there's a couple rants here around disinformation, and the reason I like this wasn't sort of the usual political stuff, but because this guy calls out the fact that there is actually an economic model for calling out disinformation. So there's a model for disinformation, and then there's a model for labeling things disinformation, and they both can generate money. And so it's kind of like, well, it is definitely a hall of mirrors. It seems like whatever you consume online, somebody making a buck on that somewhere or another.
And I had to laugh out loud at this line. What if these concepts are the result of deliberate and coordinated attempts to mislead the public?
Yeah, well, it gets me with a lot of these discussions is this reductionism we seem to be stuck in. It's like, is it true or false? It's like, everything is one variable, true or false.
Given that we have hundreds of years of history of this never occurring in the past,
yeah, why would
you expect it to suddenly occur today?
It's almost
everybody's
as if...
Everybody's benevolent today, Greg. The world has changed. Everybody just wants everybody to be nice. Problem is, they're not.
Yeah, some people have been mean to me in the past. Yeah, I don't know. I think that there is an economic model in taking complex topics and making them very simple and then getting people upset over them. And that's sort of the meta sort of engine there, and that's probably a bad idea. So, good news, guys. Even though it's still bad online on Facebook to talk about beating up or punching your neighbor, you can talk about shooting Russian soldiers. But the Facebook's decided that's okay. Violence toward other people, no, not so much, but Russians in Ukraine, fair game. It's the overlords have said this is fair for us to talk about. And I'm taking this, by the way, I'm taking this article at face value. I didn't do the research on this. I just thought it was a funny line.
It's always the old, you're us or you're against us. So it's always, you know, socially acceptable to beat up on the bad guy as long as there's a clear bad guy. Which in this case, you know, depending on the side of the line you're on, there is.
I hate what's going on in Ukraine. It's a horrible thing. It makes me very upset. Having said all of that, this is a wonderful way for all of us to take a look inside ourselves and say, am I being consistent? The rules I'm applying here that I would apply a year ago to these other topics. Because in this case, we got some really bad shit going on. And so whatever you want to have happen here, as far as free speech goes, should have been the same rules you were applying a year ago.
Yep,
well,
I don't...
The entire situation is very messy as well. But there are no innocents really involved. Both sides have done some fairly awful things. And by the way, I'm a fairly strong Ukraine supporter.
Yeah, I'm just...
It's just, I hope everything just ends quickly.
It's too late for that.
Yeah,
It
hasn't been that quick. Hopefully quick from now. Certainly, Greg, with you.
Greg and I were talking yesterday. It was like, no, everybody can lose here. I'm sorry, Scott?
I don't really look.
How much we lose.
Yeah,
it is fascinating to watch it play out, and and we have a war playing out in real time, a war that we're interested in, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
It's not as if we haven't had wars play out in real time in other parts of the world, but now we're in Europe, so suddenly we're interested for some reason, and we're watching it play out in real time with some information trickling out from various sources. And it's inaccurate. But for example, a couple of days ago, this gentleman who had been pitched as the, one of the best snipers in the world, his Canadian guy went over to hunt Russians and he's the best sniper in the world, blah blah blah, and he'd been reported killed by the Russians a couple of weeks ago. This guy popped up, a few days ago now. He had no idea that he was dead, and he had all these messages because he finally got hooked into the phone system. Had all these messages from friends and family of, oh my God, where are you? So you can imagine. And that's how he found out that he was dead. And actually revealed to everybody that he wasn't dead. And that he wasn't the world's best sniper, and then he wasn't out hunting Russia. Well, he was hunting, but he hadn't, you know, slaughtered billions of Russians as you know people have been saying he was. But he certainly wasn't dead. So it was fascinating to watch the misinformation just across the board, and some of it was just as we're seeing this play out in real time. But it's also, you know, we saw some purposeful misinformation as well.
I'm just curious on this. So did he put out a video where he came online and said, "The rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated"?
I think he said he was the last to hear of it. He was dead. He was.
he'd been out in the field for a couple weeks, right? And then he finally, you know, got cell connectivity. And all these messages came in of, "Oh my God, are you dead? You know, what's going on here?" And that's when he found that he had apparently died. Like he'd been executed 2 weeks ago.
Was it even a sniper?
Yeah.
Just an average sniper, or was he a sniper at all?
Oh, he's probably pretty darn. Yeah. But he wasn't claiming to be the world's best sniper, and he wasn't the guy that, you know, pop somebody from, you know, 7 kilometers away or whatever the world record is. He was just a pretty good sniper, but he wasn't claiming he was the best, and he had no pretensions of that. But he'd been played as the best sniper in the world, and then he'd gone over to hunt Russians, and he was doing his thing, and then the Russians claimed that they popped him, and just misinformation all over.
So I want to tie in something Scott said earlier with what we were, while we brought this topic up. He said, you know, we're interested in these as if we weren't interested in other wars. And I can hear the little chorus of, because there are people, whatever. Here's the point. I'm interested in Civil War stuff, not because I want to bring back slavery or I want to get out of my gray uniform and march around. I'm interested in the U.S. Civil War because it's the best example I know of where my civilization lost a war. We worshiped the same God, we had the same country, we had a lot of the same beliefs, and we lost. And to me, that's quite fascinating. You can draw a lot of parallels in that history. I believe the same thing's happening in Ukraine. In Ukraine, we have a modern country who's plugged into Facebook. A lot of people were English-speaking. They were shooting. They did the Ukrainian Revolution a few years back. They had videos. These are people who are living much like we are living. Matter of fact, they voted to be free, and yet they're going through this horrible, horrible thing. And I hate to sound like a cold person, but it's fascinating because there's all these parallels. How are they using social media? How are they using drones? You know, how does their Russian Orthodox Christianity plug into what they're doing? Right?
How could the U.S. have won the Civil War? No matter what happened, they lost.
There's this fun, you play armchair games about how they could have won or lost, but to me the interesting story is, in the U.S., you're like the first example of the draft ever happening in the Civil War. The first example of, like, government rationing. We had all this stuff that we did later that happened for the first time because we were busy killing one another, which is a bad thing, but it makes you learn about systems by examining them under pressure. And so here in Ukraine, we have a technological civilization very similar to ours. It's under a hell of pressure, and it's a sad, sad chance for us, but it is a chance to sort of look at How are they adapting? What's happening? Because there's another article here where they're using drones to kick the shit out of the Russian army, and that could change a lot of things.
Impressive if even half the information is correct.
Yeah, I wonder if tanks haven't gone the way of the battleships. You know, after World War I, we built all these battleships, and come World War II, we found out that none of them were really useful for much.
I hope we have an article about that this week.
We do.
Oh, good.
Tractor technology is pretty impressive, though. So you've got, if you ever looked at a modern tractor, there's some pretty cool stuff going on in tractors.
Yes.
So yeah, going up against the latest John Deere, I can see how the farmers are kicking the Russian butts on that one.
You think, do they have John Deere's over there?
I think, yeah. No, they don't. No, of course they have John Deere. No, they don't allow the tractors to go places. I'm sorry, James. I didn't mean to pick up. But yeah, they have all sorts of. They have electricity and telephones. It's.
Well, I just thought about the brand name. I suppose John Deere is a worldwide
company
in Ukraine is a major producer of grain, so yes. Yeah, okay, they've got John Deere's.
True fact, no, John Deere's...
No, they don't.
They don't have
them. No, there is actually, going all the way back to the Soviet days, I believe, a large tractor factory that's over in Kharkiv.
Oh.
Where they have manufactured their own tractors. So and I believe it's Kharkiv, but I'm not positive. Worth bringing up a Google if you want to know, but I think it's a Kharkiv.
Well, regardless of the brand, there's some pretty good tractor action going on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, if you're into tractor action, that's the place to go. They're getting down. I saw that they actually found a Russian electronic warfare. I posted that in our room.
A couple days ago.
Amazing stuff.
What I'm waiting for is when everything is finally settled down. Let's say 5 years from now, and we can go to Ukraine for the tractor match-off.
Actually, there is a John Deere featured in one of these. They're pulling the tank away with the John Deere. It's got the yellow wheels and the green paint and everything.
Yeah, I knew this, but I didn't want to give it away. Yeah. True fact, John Deere is the oldest incorporated U.S. company. I think they were incorporated like 1816 or something.
So this before the tractors.
So speaking of...
If they had John Deere's just a few years earlier, you guys wouldn't have lost the War of 1812. Maybe not.
And we can never miss a chance to bring that up now. Yeah. Who can forget those friendly redcoats showing up in Washington and burning the whole place down?
No, like, it used to be bragging rights, but now apparently anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, the first time's cool, but then by the second or third time, it's like, oh, man, not again.
Second or third time is it.
So speaking of warfare and electronics, this is a new idea. This is called algorithmic destruction. And so the Federal Trade Commission is now using algorithmic destruction as a tool. Long story short, Weight Watchers, in this example, build a machine learning model based on all these data points, which took a lot of cycles, a ton of money. And they were screwing up by taking private data, so the FTC stepped in and just killed their program. Way cool, or bad.
So will they go after Facebook?
Well, it's not just that. The thing here is that data is the new oil. They've been saying it for 10 years now. And so now we're seeing civil actions coming in, government actions seizing property. And like it's like taking pot out and burning it. It's like, wow, you used to have this thing you spent all this effort on, and now it's just gone forever.
How do they guarantee they actually killed it off? Right? Have they not heard of backups and weird concepts like that?
Well, I think that some of these models are so large that you don't back them up. They're just continuously running and adapting as they go.
Hmm.
Yeah, you don't back up like a 4-petabyte system. That just don't happen.
A 4-petabyte system would actually cost a couple $100 to back up.
That's what I'm saying. A lot of money.
A couple hundred.
Nobody would need who would need a 4-petabyte system?
Somebody with 4 petabytes of data? I don't know, 2 petabytes?
Yeah, I'm losing track of the prefixes. Okay, we got terabytes.
See what happens.
Petabytes. Is there a yottabyte, right? A zettabyte?
Picobytes or
yada
bytes. There's a yada yada byte. Yeah, picobytes are like the little tiny guys that run around.
troglobytes. I think
there's a troglobyte. Yes, that's the underground bytes.
Mm-hmm. That's for fossilized data usually.
So welcome, essential craftsman, whoever that may be. Welcome to the room. I know you're lurking. It's fine to lurk. I don't think you can actually cam up, but if you go over to the Nerd Roundup texting channel, you can type in text to introduce yourself. We're happy to talk to you while we do our thing.
Well, that did not turn out very well.
Square them up. We scared them
up. Oh.
Someone's popping in to say hi.
This is like when you do your first yard sale, and you wait for an hour, and somebody finally shows up. Hey, how's it going? Have you seen these cups over here? So speaking of machine learning reimagines the building blocks of computing. So the theme here with the FTC case and with the Facebook case and with this story here is that we're building algorithms we do not understand ourselves, and then either we're applying them to people or we're burning them in the field, or we're doing these things with this these concepts that we really don't know what the hell we're doing. But it seems to be fun, so we keep doing it. This is
Spider-Man, when they keep reimagining his origin story here. But anyways, so.
Definitely like the photo. It has probably nothing to do with the article, I'm pretty sure. I didn't see anything.
The example here is the new stuff they're doing with machine learning and traditional data algorithms. And so, you know, you may have a bounce tree, if you guys know what that is, or, well, red-blue tree, the different sorts of algorithms we use to look up and store data. And so they're combining that with ML to sort of, I guess, in some cases, the machine can be extra smart and, like, push past the algorithmic limits on theoretical. It's like, if I know everything that starts with an A, the answer is 4, I really don't have to build a big tree. And so by looking at patterns in the higher level data, sometimes the machine can kind of bullshit its way through the system. And it works fine, but my point is it's not a mathematical system anymore. It's just a guessing system, right?
No. So we're also missing on something rather important here. So while it might improve the big O, there is still that C, which is always ignored. Which, my guess, it adds a lot to.
Yes. I see, yes. Oh. That's all the puns I got for that one. I'm sorry. So Greg was referring to big O notation, which is how long it takes a machine to go through it. I think by C you're talking about clock cycles or computation?
No. So in big O, so like let's say I have big O at the end. I can also have a constant time added to this. You can imagine I would write a really, really ridiculous algorithm that would check every single item 1,000 times as it moved forward, as opposed to the one that it needed to do. They would have the same big O, and all of that would get written down into the C.
Yes. Yeah, and they're pushing those cycles out to the hardware now. So they've got another dinner plate sized AI chip they're selling. I think Intel came out with it. Or no, it's NVIDIA, which is trying to push all that C stuff, just push everything out to the machine. Ooh, I like it, James. Looking good, dude.
I like the picture.
I'm just here for the pictures, really. That's the reason.
Sorry, anybody say something important in them? That time? No?
Nah, it's pretty much the same. Yeah, it's not important.
Scott said no.
Yes, maybe.
Okay, so continuing on the what the hell is it, looks good to me theme. Can brain scans reveal behavior? Bombshell study says not yet. And so this is super cool to me because I was on a forum about 4 or 5 years ago with some, some practitioners of medical research. And they were making the case that we're reading way, way too much stuff into brain scans that just isn't there. And now they're actually doing the math behind it and saying, yeah, we probably are. We're not using that. We're trying to do three-dimensional pattern matching with not enough sample sizes. We have boils down to. But yeah, so we're seeing a lot of studies like people with this part of their brain bigger than normal, like octopuses, that just simply are not true studies. The results are not there.
Wait, we have a bunch of studies that use small sample sizes and then extrapolated results, often with catchy headlines associated to them? Yeah. Who would ever imagine something happening?
But wait, there's more. Yeah, it's not... Well, see, the thing is, we talk about control studies and then p-hacking with normal studies, and that's one thing that we're finding, the reproducible crisis in psychology, for instance. This is even worse because it's three-dimensional imaging that they're using machine learning, once again, to sort of find patterns in. So it's like, first of all, it's another order of magnitude more complex. Second of all, they're using a pattern matching system that they don't understand what the patterns are. And third, that the mathematics don't have enough data. So it's bad all the way around, really. But they're cool pictures.
PhDs.
Well, yeah, they got the cool pictures.
So we're good.
Yeah.
It is a cool picture.
pretty much just...
I actually think this is a big problem in many academic areas today.
Yep.
That you are kind of forced to publish.
Yes.
Forced to publish too early. Like, there's this nasty decision point, right? It's, I got some data, it's looking good, I think I got a theory, but not really good yet, I gotta go because some clown down the street will publish it in an hour and a half. And now I'm done.
Well, and if if you don't publish, then you'll be knocked out.
Yeah.
You are valued based upon your publishings, not based upon the actual work that you're doing.
Yeah, I think Thomas Kuhn also had the thing about neuroscience and paradigm breaking science. His point was that the political system, the social system of doing science, is sort of predicated on not telling people they're completely wrong, but just sort of advancing things a little bit. So you see a lot of science that people get PhD and they defend their thesis where they're like, hey, you're mostly right, guys, but it's like 5% different than you thought it was. And then that kind of stuff kind of sails through, whereas admittedly the mostly completely wrong folks who are out there and outliers don't ever get funded to even have a chance to be proven wrong. The system is rigged to not progress quickly, basically.
There's a certain amount of missing
system
people
taking incremental improvement.
I did not hear that.
Talking to somebody that's in a situation like that, where they have to vie for research dollars, there is a people have to pay their dues. They've got to try a whole bunch of times before they'll ever get a chance of getting funded.
Yep. There's that Netflix study about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos that's got some really cool stuff in it regarding using professors and what, you know, that whole thing turned out to be a big fake.
What's a fake? More fake news?
Theranos. They had this idea that they would take a drop of blood and tell you everything about your medical history. And the professors at Stanford said, no, that's not enough volume of blood. And they're like, oh, we can do this because theoretically it might work. And I mean, they went through, I think, close to $1 billion. And finally they said, hey, you know, it's not enough blood, which academia knew to begin with. But what she did, the CEO, was she very wisely co-opted the system. So this gets back to the social system of science. She went to some professors who were looking to invest in a startup. She got them to sign off. Then she got some investors. And it became a political, social thing. And not really a company that was doing science.
Running any company is a political, social.
Motherfucker. It is. And when you deal with a lot of money, there's a lot of mixed incentives, I guess would be a nice way of putting it. Speaking of money, this is a really cool tweet I saw the other day. These top five JavaScript web APIs for every web developer. I included this because browsers have come a long ways in the last 20 years, and so a lot of things we used to use external systems and companies for are actually built into the browser now. There's a checkout payment system, there's a geolocation, there's all this cool stuff that web developers can use without having to use third-party libraries.
But these are third-party libraries, right? Or this is just part
no,
of
no, no, this is like jQuery. Like these things were invented as libraries 20 years ago, and then everybody started using them, and then the browser guy said, let's just build it into the browser. So this has been built into the browser now, so you don't have
are
to...
Are you suggesting the guys building the browser are not a third party?
They're not to me. I love those guys.
I'm just thinking maybe there's some software bloat going on.
No. Yes, there's the Ukrainian John Deere tractor API. That's a.
This fetch thing seemed like that could be useful. What am I going to do with that?
I come up with the.
What I really want to know is why we have all of these things built in the browsers, but we still don't have decent data visualizations built in them when you're actually trying to write code.
Look behind me. Look at this visualization.
Yeah.
Built into the browser, I bet you.
Yeah. What the world needs.
Math lab.
We need a 7 cent nickel. That's what the world needs, because the nickel isn't what it used to be. If you had a 7 cent nickel, solve a lot of problems. You could buy like a piece of gum and get change back and use the same nickel again.
But then you'd have to adopt the metric system.
Yeah, I don't think you have to learn completely speak Canadian. I think you can just, it's okay just to use like some metric. Like a micro Canadian is like a little beer maybe or something. I don't know. I lose track of it.
Like a small beer.
Yeah.
Alcohol that American beer. But anyways.
Make you love it a rowboat. Got to go for that joke, right? You guys have heard that.
So long as we're not having Molson, I'm good.
I'm a Labatt's guy.
How about Moosehead?
Yeah, Moosehead's okay, but I really like my Labatt's Blue. Scott, you're required by law to drink beer. What is your favorite beer?
Yeah, well, I'm more of a craft, you know, local craft beer guy, you know, wherever I am in the world. But sadly, the dirty secret of the craft beer companies is they tend to get picked off by the, you know, the Molsons and Labatt's of the world pretty quickly. So I think as a craft beer, you know, might have been, you know, 5 years ago, but now you're really drinking Molsons again.
Yeah. Being a keto guy, I haven't had beer in 3 or 4 years, but I understand there is a zero carb beer out now, and go figure on that one. I'm still trying to work that one out.
Yep.
Cold water.
Yeah, it's what is it? Yeah, ultra beer or something.
Yeah, beer flavored seltzer water.
Yeah, they call it.
There is a joke about Canadians in a canoe having a beer.
Yeah. So we gotta hear it now. Hey.
No, I'm gonna stay away from it. I'm gonna put it up.
Okay, hey, you guys at home, if your parents say it's okay, late at night, you're welcome to look up this Canadians in a rowboat joke. But we're not gonna repeat it here.
It's a canoe, I think.
Yes, well, the make you love in the rowboat was the one I heard. It's the same punchline.
There we go.
So next story is, does Ukraine spell the death of operational level offense? And so we've been doing last couple of years, we've been doing a lot of DOD weapons stuff, not because I like hurting people or I'm a person who loves guns, but the reason I'm doing sort of military level technology, first of all, military technology projects are huge. Second of all, if you don't do it right, people die. So there's a lot of pressure. And third of all, we're seeing a lot of innovation in that area because people don't want to die, which is also a good thing. So here we're seeing a story about the Ukrainians using commercial off-the-shelf software, drones, and hear them tell it. They're just kicking the living shit out of the Russians. You know, and the Russians have $100,000, $1 million pieces of equipment. And you're taking like a $400 drone and destroying it. Pretty wild.
No, this is actually fairly expected. So, if I'm going to build something, and I have worked with delivering military level things in the U.S., I can assure you that with all of the process associated, I could build something similar to it for a much, much lower cost.
Yes. Yes.
Don't get me wrong, it might only be 95% as effective. But that last 5% was 80% of our budget.
Yeah, no, Greg, you're right here, and I should have clarified myself. I think the reason I'm especially interested in this is the fact that we know this as technologists, right? We can see the difference between what you could build and what they're paying for. And it's like, okay, well, how's this going to shake out? Did they buy the $1 billion thing that's actually going to work against the $1,000, $100? I mean, did that math work out the way they thought it was going to work out? So far, no, it doesn't look like it.
Well, there was the $20 hammers, right, and $100 toilet seats. I guess $100 toilet seats might not be as out of line anymore.
That's how you fight the aliens off, man. I saw that in Independence Day. That's how you fight the aliens.
The government's known this for a while. So my father's a remote control airplane guy, and his flying club was near one of the largest nuclear power plants in the world. So once a year, the RCMP would come in and give them the keep your eye out speech, because they wanted them to actively keep an eye out for anybody that didn't really know what they're doing, but would show up. A reasonably large plane like from a remote control plane point of view, because you could load enough C4 onto something like that and slam it into the side of the power plant, which they were concerned about for some reason. So yeah, once a year the RCP would come in and give them the scenario, here's the scenarios we would really like to be kept apprised of, because you're at the top of the list.
In the last 2 years, the United States Marine Corps has gone through a major reorg, and what they've decided to do is this: fighting the big war is not going to work anymore. We're going to fight little small groups, little technology dispersed here and there. They've decided that's where they're going. They got rid of all their tanks, which is amazing for the Marines, and they're thinking, hey, instead of being all of us versus all of you, it's going to be five Marines on an island somewhere with some anti-ship missiles. It's a new world we're headed into.
By the way, I had just, based on the comments previously sent over to Daniel, a list of $100 toilet seats.
It's probably a long list.
I know what I'm asking Santa for.
In Canada, why do you have to worry about somebody flying explosives into a nuclear power station? I thought everybody loves Canadians.
They do. It's just the, if you're bored one day and you want to kill a lot of people, then you can do that.
Well, but
and it's right. It's actually across the lake from Michigan.
Yeah.
So you time it for when the winds are.
It's those out of towners you got to worry about. Those Americans from down south. Huh?
No. In Canada, the main problem is that everyone loves the Canadians except for the Canadians.
Okay. So it'd be homegrown then.
Homegrown guys, yeah.
Oh, can you imagine Quebec and Ottawa having a go at it?
Well, yeah, there's some.
That's Friday night.
Probably because you said hello to somebody in English, right?
Yeah, I can't imagine the Quebec people being upset about much of anything. They're pretty laid back, right? So
there used to be a delta in the drinking time. So in Ottawa, the bars would close at 1, and then right across the bridge. In Quebec, they would close at 3, right? So you get all the drunk people walk across the bridge and drink for another 2 hours. And then there'd usually be a scuffle, Sometimes there'd be a scuffle. Oh, yeah.
good times.
Well, but what's hilarious from my time in Canada, at least, is that what you generally run into as well is that all of these people are bilingual.
Hey, watch it. They're welcome to worship whichever god they want to. Okay, I think it's.
You'll be walking across the bridge and yelling at those stupid francophones in French as an anglophone, or vice versa.
I get you in English.
So, next story, he said, changing the subject subtly, Windows needs to change in priorities. And this is probably one of the best tech rants I've read in the last month or two. Windows 11 has at least 12 different user interface motifs they're using at the same time. It's a frickin' mess in there. He goes down a list of, trying to bring up, a date picker or OK button, and there are 8 different ways of doing it. They all give you a different answer. And you look at the UI, and there's 8 different ways. It's just a mess. It's a total mess in here.
Bloat in Windows is the article. And that, what part of the 90s was that published in?
din.dev, whatever that is.
Is any of this surprising or new?
Cool. Come on. Windows, really?
at least one point in every nerd run up, Greg has to go, well, none of this is surprising. No, it's not. Windows has been a dumpster fire for quite a while. It has.
Okay. Do you want to have a fun little statistic?
I would like a statistic, please.
We want a fun one.
No, just not any. I want a fun. This had better be fun, okay? Because if you just give me a regular statistic, I'm going to be disappointed.
Windows and Microsoft Office alone are 220 million lines of code.
Wow.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, that's kind of fun. I like that. That's good.
is put in by the shovel load. How do you
You're literally at a quarter billion lines of code.
How do you
only
get a quarter billion
Windows
lines of code?
And for Office.
Okay, so Greg, how do you get a quarter billion lines of code?
Oh, I think we all know the answer to that one.
One line at a time.
No, one copy paste at a time. You'd be much more efficient that way.
Yeah, one program manager at a time, more than likely. Everybody's got a little cost center, and you got a little kingdom, and you're going to do things your way to make more money than the other guy.
Can you imagine dealing with a quarter billion lines of code?
I can. It's sort of the same way I can imagine Dante's nine levels of hell. I think it, like, at the very center would be that scenario there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all in one folder.
Yeah, one folder. It's got this huge scroll bar on it. It's like, whoa.
Well, but the thing is, even with something like, if we were to take Event Store, Event Store is a reasonably large product. But you can, as a human being, come into it, you can understand it, and you can work inside of that source code. There are very clear boundaries of what is Event Store.
Yes. I used to call them architectural conceits, right? So you want, as a new programmer, to have conceits, like patterns of doing things, and that pattern to hold up throughout the source code. So it doesn't matter how big the code is. If you've got a pattern you can learn easily and use that over and over again, you can work your way through. But 11 different UI models, I am working.
But when we start talking about code bases this size, it's literally, you are going to be walking into something you've never seen before.
Yeah. Yeah, Jimmy Hoffa down here somewhere now.
Well, and I imagine pretty much, because every company I've ever worked for, we had different rates of change across different pieces of code. So there's probably a substantial amount of code, which literally nobody in the company even knows.
Yes. Yeah, that would be
the
true.
Guy
like
who
a tenth
knew
of that
it
now.
Left 10 years ago.
And that's true early on.
We used to have some things back a long time ago included in some of the embedded systems I worked on where all you had was a binary. You didn't even have any source code for it. It's like, let's hope this keeps working.
I have done the same, but, sir.
For that, though, because then you're not screwing with it.
But we actually had, and I think I brought this up a while ago, we had a bigger problem on one of our embedded systems. So we had the source code for it. But is the source code what's actually currently in production?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Probably not. If you're asking, probably.
I was going to say, you'd think, well, okay, just recompile the source code, do a binary comparison, you're good, right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Except we don't know which version of the compiler it was compiled with. And then there were compression things that were done on top for the EEPROM.
Yeah, and I think even if you get that right, even if you get the comparison right, there's a semantic slicing that occurs where you're in the code somewhere way down and you've got like a foo, and you think you've got this foo that this guy made over here, maybe the one you used last week, but no, you got a different foo that this other guy used, and because you didn't take the time to trace it all the way from the feature down into the code to see which foo you have, you make assumptions about what you're using instead of actually knowing it, right?
No. The problem was we have our source code, but we're not sure this is the thing that's actually running in production.
No, I got you. I'm just saying it's even worse than that. You can know it's in production and not know what that you're modifying the thing that's actually currently running. In other words, the binaries can be the same. You can be making foo do bar now, but you have the wrong freaking foo. So you've got the binary, you're doing the thing, but you're using the old semantic version of foo. Fixing the binary doesn't even fix that problem, is my point, right?
So, Greg, a friend of mine...
The answer is no. The answer is no.
Yeah.
Regardless, you can't trust it.
No.
If you're asking that question, the answer is you don't know.
Yes. Yep.
Well, but then the question becomes, and this is something that I do not hear often discussed about software engineering. So how do we move forward from this?
Oh yeah, there's
and it's actually an interesting problem. So what we generally should start doing is introducing some bugs deliberately.
Yes, freaking A, man.
Bugs, and ensuring those bugs exist when we introduce them.
To agree with Greg, you know, chaos engineering is all about doing that at the cloud levels, cloud scale. So I mean that's why you want to do chaos engineering. If you the system reaches a point you don't understand it, you should purposely make it fail, and then therefore start developing your resiliency skills, because understanding skills aren't going to take you but so far.
Or you build in identification functionality. If you don't know what you got, you should be able to ask it.
Yes.
Who are you?
Yes.
Well, but that's a good long-term goal.
3.9.9.
Yeah. That's a good long-term goal, but it doesn't work in the short term.
So here's what, this is a little bit different, but a friend of mine was trying to untangle a mass of conditional compilations that were no longer needed, and he wanted to get the same binary out. And so basically he kept pulling out more and more of the conditional compilations, and each time making sure he got the exact same binary, and continued that until he got rid of all the ancient conditional compilation he didn't want anymore. So he's kind of proving that I can get the exact same thing back.
And you can also do that around you can do that at the feature level too. If you've got an app that has drivers that hit the database and drivers take input, you can actually replicate it like several times and just take one feature path and rip everything off but that one feature path and keep that piece, and then do the same thing with the other pieces, that if you follow what I'm saying, right? That will also work.
Say Microsoft, and you had 220 million lines of code. SharePoint, so you probably can't even find it anymore. Nah.
They don't even know which crap isn't being executed anymore.
Yes, that's true.
No way.
True statement. So the next article is, new rocket engine could reach 99% the speed of light. And I love these UFO story, rocket engine stories. This is by a NASA scientist, supposedly. The little I know, it makes sense to me. This does not look like another EM drive. And let me explain it real quickly. As I understand this, the guy takes ions, electrically charged particles, wiggles them back and forth in the magnetic field to relativistic speeds, all right? So they gain a lot of mass. And then he pulls them back at the very end, and that mass gets converted to energy, so there's a momentum conveyed to the system through the ion. So it's like an ion internal slingshot thing going on. It would not work.
Just be very careful here, because by definition, this is not a rocket.
It's a propulsion system?
Yes, it is a propulsion system, yeah. Shocking.
So the mass to
could it be a rocket engine? So by definition, a rocket has to spew out...
It goes in a rocket, it's an engine. Rocket engine.
But it's called an engine.
Yeah. What else would you call it? Like a rocket?
Greg, what's the technicality here, Greg? Help me out.
Oh, it's just that a rocket has a reasonably defined role that it plays.
Yes. Yes.
They have used them in space in the past.
Yeah.
But what we're discussing here would not necessarily be a rocket.
Two definitions. Yeah. Is a rocket a thing that shoots things out the back, or is a rocket a thing that propels spaceships? Up to now, the answer has been yes for both of those, but this would be sort of on the borderline, kind of.
There's a propulsion system that gets darn close to the speed of light, is what I just heard. How did they deal with the infinite mass? You know, the mass is going to approach infinity on that one. How did they deal with that?
Well, it doesn't take you right away. There's no magic, like, force. You build this huge 400-foot thing just to get a tiny bit of force, but it can keep going. The speed can keep increasing. By converting energy directly into momentum, you only go a little faster at a time, but because that momentum is near the speed of light, the eventual speed of the rocket would be close to the speed of light.
If I remember correctly as well, and I have someone I can ask and discuss a bit about it, you basically have an exponential curve here, where the closer and closer that you get to it, the harder and harder it gets.
Yes.
Without too much effort.
We're talking about the exhaust speed of this engine. Like this. Yeah, we're talking about the exhaust speed being close.
Use that to get over to where the problem stars of it.
That providing a certain amount of food of certain types that you could fart into your car and drive it.
Not that you would just be in the car farting, because
point B, I think.
Yeah.
I've lost Dan's sound. It's me.
Well, I'm sorry, guys. Yeah, I actually hit the wrong button and stopped and started the recording again, but that's fine. Yeah, you don't want to get inside the car and fart. That's just not a good idea.
The windows are rolled down, but the but actually,
then you waste all your fuel.
Also, thing, there was an Andy Griffith show years ago where he was a junkyard. He built a spaceship out of a junkyard in his. He had just regular acceleration to get it to get to space. But anyways.
What? No, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, I remember this. Oh, what was that? Artemis 1? I remember that. That was a TV show, wasn't it?
Yeah, or Junkyard 1 or something. I don't know, something like that. But yeah, he was an ex-rocket scientist who owned a junkyard for some reason. And he built a junkyard spaceship. And his idea, he had consistent acceleration.
Uh-huh.
Which is, so he didn't have to have a lot of power as long as he had consistent acceleration. Was basically the entire premise of the show.
Well, you know, if you could convert electricity directly into propulsion, it takes like I think $1.50 worth of electricity to actually put you in orbit. It's just nobody can convert that direct. Can't do a direct conversion. Okay, so I got two more.
Dear, are we suggesting that we need longer cables?
At least for my computer, I do. So we have the Sonic Pi, which is a Raspberry Pi. This is really, really cool, guys. If you're a programmer, there's a demo video you should watch. This is a Lisp system where as you write the Lisp code, it's actually creating music at the same time. It is just really, really wild. And so it's like this combination of coding.
Wait. I know a lot more about this than anyone else.
Okay.
So the Sonic Pi is absolutely freaking cool.
Yay!
It is been around for quite some time. It's now actually based on Ruby, which is kind of bizarre. And Sam has literally been working on this for a decade.
It is the video I saw was amazing. I'm not sure if it was like super cool or it blew my mind as a musician and a programmer. It's like, holy shit, you can like real time code and make music. I just never occurred to me that those would go together.
Well, but what's really hilarious about it is that this has been going for a decade.
Yeah.
This is not like some new thing that just came out last Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, this came on Hacker News last Tuesday, and somebody said, well, you know, Sonic Pi's been going on for a decade, and this is why this is on Nerdground. There's an HN article about some competitor. Oh. And so, yeah.
Higher pitch code than that.
So, yeah, there was an HN article about a similar thing, and the guy said, no, this is much better, so I brought this up. There's also a Talking Piano article. This guy has invented a talking piano. There's a video here as well. Not as cool as the Lisp music making box, but still, if you like a piano with live balls that talks to you, it's a real piano. It's just weird. Okay, so this last one, besides the inflatable airplane, which we got to go, but this last one is new experiment confirmed the fifth element. Now, I don't know if you guys have followed along, but the fifth element is a movie put out in, I think, 1987 or 1988. We have more than five elements already. We've got at least seven or eight when I was in chemistry class. A bunch of them. There's a big chart of them.
You got a PhD chemist for a son. I was going to ask him. I think you're a little bit low on the count.
Yes, I think they were shooting for
at least 10.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, they got different letters, I think. So, yeah, I think he's talking fifth phase of matter. I think what he's trying to get to. Long and short, there's two articles here if you go to the linked list. Does information have mass? Is information its own form of matter, just like light and other things? And they're still arguing that if they do, that means that programmers could be like, you know, masters of the universe, literally.
Well, this obviously must be true.
Some information has mass, like this massive thing.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I have to think all we need to do is call up Microsoft and ask them how much their 220 million lines of code weighs. Only somebody should know that.
Right. And how much coal gets burned when they trigger that Windows.h recompile.
Oh, my God. There's got to be somebody who has to bring up this whole tree at some point in some box somewhere.
It'll be a bit of a more than one box, I'd think, there. But,
Proof.
Okay, so tell us about the fifth element. It's information? The fifth element is information?
Yeah, so there's been an argument about dark matter, dark energy. Things don't add up in cosmology and physics, and it hasn't for some time. There's a MOND theory, M-O-N-D, and they basically say, yep, actually, information is its own form of matter, and this guy says he has an experiment that can prove yay nor nay. And I don't really know what to feel about this, but it makes me feel cool as a programmer, so I like it. I think it's a good idea.
So I'm just kind of curious about this, because it's a little bit of a side question, but what happens to information around a black hole?
Well, yeah, see, I think that's one of the drivers here, is that they're trying to figure out what happens to information in a black hole. This is the holographic principle says that you can only space can only have enough information that would be expressed by a similar encompassing two-dimensional surface. So all this stuff is pointing toward the universe actually being information, but they're not really proved it yet. It's just sort of conjecture at this point. Black holes are fuzzy. I read that last week. They got fuzzy black holes now. I don't know if you guys saw that song.
Oh, come on. They've been around for quite some time. They've grown up a bit. They're getting beards now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a true story. Yeah. They used to have the flaming barrier of death, which really wasn't that big a selling point. But now they got kind of peach fuzzy black holes. I like those much, much better, I think.
Well, I haven't watched it yet, but apparently on Discovery, they went past the galactic barrier again. Original series doing that, or movie number 5 doing that as well. If Star Trek Discovery is doing it, it must be true.
There you go. See, that's I think that's probably the final word in any sort of science question. Right? You look at Star Trek.
Yeah.
Star Trek put head on that.
I'll say this again, the original Star Trek was campy and bad in a lot of ways, but it was cool because nobody had invented any of this stuff before, with the exception of maybe Doctor Who. And so they just pulled this stuff out of thin air and just threw it, like they threw cups from the mess hall on the wall, made them little controls in the engineering room. That was the fun part of that.
I've always wondered about Star Trek is that they've had different alien species who are able to breed together.
Yeah. Bumpy heads. They're all aliens are just people with bumpy heads. I didn't know that until I watched Star Trek.
What gets really interesting about the possibility of interbreeding, allow that to happen, you must have had some previous thing that seeded those lives all of those places.
You're talking about Tinder, aren't you?
Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Spock swiped left a few times. Man, we got a whole new Star Trek episode there, right?
It's known as the Kirk maneuver.
Yeah, you know, I gotta admit, as a heterosexual teenage boy, I'm thinking this Star Trek travel thing is looking pretty freaking awesome, you know? Every week. I doubt it's going to be like that, though. Goodyear Inflatoplane, the last story.
91.
What'd you say? Oh, yeah, turned 91 yesterday to the Shatner.
Turned 91
today. 91! Yeah. He's outliving all of them.
Yeah, they showed a funny picture of him, like, pretending to be old in one of the episodes of Star Trek next to him actually being 90. He looked better at his real skin.
He's looking pretty good. Yeah. I would really love to look that good at 91. I think he's got a good shot at 100 if he keeps going that way. So last story, this Greg and I were talking about this earlier. This is way, way, way super cool. And I forget how I came across this, but in the 1950s, the Air Force was worried about pilots crashing behind enemy lines, and so Goodyear came up with an inflatable airplane backpack. When you're wearing a backpack, you crash behind enemy lines, you blow up, hope you don't blow it up, but you blow up the airplane, and then you go fly that rascal right out of there, and it works. It is a working inflatable airplane.
When did you get yours, Dan?
I would kill for one of these. This is almost better than a gyrocopter.
Come on, this would be like the coolest thing you could ever possibly have at a family picnic.
That would be great, yeah.
It would be pretty cool. How did they deal with the engine issue?
The engine's most of the way. I think it's 80 some pounds altogether, and the engine's like 60 of that.
Okay.
It doesn't take a huge amount of power. You just need to go a certain speed to get off the ground, right? Yeah.
But you got to bring 20 gallons of fuel with you. That looks like that could be a problem.
Yeah.
You got to stop at a gas station.
You know, I should look around and see if I can find a video of this, because they built several of them and did some demos. They deemed that 80 pounds was too heavy to put on a pilot's back. But, I mean, the concept works.
But James is right, though. You've got the engine, you've got the fuel. Fuel's going to add up, because you're not going to get far with only, a couple liters of fuel, right?
But you don't need to get very far.
Right, yeah, 10, 20 miles would be all you'd want, right? Yeah, it'd be fun times.
Cool. How you look at it, it's cool.
Yeah, very much. Yep. So guys, before we go, what kind of media or consumables you guys been reading? Books, movies, anything interesting? Greg, you've been...
Anyway. I've been consuming all sorts of different things. No fun movies.
Okay. Any books or a series on Netflix?
I've been mostly looking at some odd things.
Do you pay for that?
Nope.
Scott, what have you been up to as far as reading or consuming things that might be interesting?
I'm reading the last book in the Expanse series.
Ooh.
By James S. A. Corey, those two authors. And that's pretty good. Apparently they wrap things up nicely. I haven't gotten to that part yet, but they wrap everything up nicely. Been watching Star Trek Picard. Really liking that.
Yes.
You just cost me hours and hours and hours by saying that.
I will not watch Discovery, but Picard's good.
Yeah. If you haven't watched the first season, don't worry about it. But start with the second season. It's been pretty good so far. And looking forward to The Boys.
Yes.
The third season coming out in June.
Soldier Boy, yeah. My wife's a Supernatural fan, so we're all,
I don't know if you saw it. That